You're tuned in to Radio Area at RadioArea.com.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. Andy Donner here with another Radio Free Northwest rerun. Obviously, no election commentary this week. Quite frankly, that always frustrated Harold and I. It should be pretty obvious what we generally think about events, but if you want to have some fun, reply to email, the website, the message board, wherever, and let me know what you think my reaction to the election should have been, and I'll share all of that at a later date when I actually react. The rerun I've pulled for this week is actually one of my favorite Radio Free Northwest episodes of all time because of its ideological importance inside of white nationalism. No, this isn't anything about Jews or race or the world enemy or anything like that. This is about, quote-unquote, waking people up, particularly in the form of debates. One of the incredibly frustrating aspects of dealing with the white character problem is that white nationalists the world over tend to think they're going to change our situation as a race by merely waking people up because there's some super secret plan behind that door that if we can just punch through, it'll all happen. It doesn't work like that. Truth be told, facts are not what change people's minds. I know that sounds odd, but the character issue is such that people will do whatever they want to do and rationalize it after the fact. Someone becomes a true white nationalist when they start to pay attention and care about things that they already know. Now, it's true the educational importance of everything about race and the Jews and anything else you might care to put under the umbrella of white nationalist ideology matters, but it matters to shore up someone who has decided to be a white nationalist for reasons other than facts. Now, true, a lot of us experience this as a matter of, I learned this thing and I can't ignore it, but if we're introspective enough, we understand that this is more about choosing to do the right thing and then understanding why we chose that after we've committed. But I'm only 2 minutes into this introduction and I'm already rambling. I'm gonna shut up and play the rerun. See y'all next week.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 26th, 2018. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, dudes, I'm going to do something this episode which I do fairly seldom, but I'm going to front-load this episode with all of our contributors and let them go first, because we have a rather lengthy discussion topic that we need to get into. I'm hoping to get Andy in on it as well. And that kind of needs to be all of one piece in the show. So let's kick it off with Gretchen this week.
Thank you. evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to discuss a fictional novel by Maria DeMarco entitled The Secret Book of Adolf Hitler. This type of format has been a temptation for many authors, and this author deserves some credit for her honesty because she openly admits that this is historical fiction, rather than, like some earlier authors, trying to con people into saying that they have an actual journal. Of course, Hitler was a man of the spoken word. For him, National Socialism is expressed as an oral tradition. So, Adolf Hitler was someone, clearly, who devoted his life to Germany, and he didn't really have much of a private life. But what he did have was closely guarded. And, of course, any journaling, there's always the danger that someone may find your journal, that someone may read it. So, of course, Hitler was not one to ever write a diary. And if he did write an actual diary, I would not care to violate his privacy. To the author's credit, she is not unaware of the absurdity of this book. However, if we can ignore the absurdity, we can enjoy the stories of his early years, which are in fact based on research. Now, as we all know, Adolf Hitler did not get along with his father. This was largely due to the fact that his father was abusive, both to Adolf and also his mother. And as a result of this, Adolf is driven by a strong desire for personal accomplishment and dignity. The author writes about a time when the young Hitler, like many young children, was upset with his parents, and essentially he wanted to run away from home. Now, this was not a very well-planned exit from his home, and he tries to run off. It's the middle of winter, and he tries to cross a river, and the ice breaks, and he almost drowns. But he's called back by a mysterious voice to a great destiny. Now, years later, during World War I, this would happen again, and I'm sure we all know the story. Adolf was having lunch near a couple of other soldiers, and he hears an order that seems to come from nowhere to move out of the way. Hitler listens to the voice, and just seconds later, the other two men that were having their lunch were killed by a shell that just randomly exploded. This would happen actually many times during Hitler's life, and he seems to have been someone who had to choose the date of his own death because it seems that he was incapable of being killed. Getting back to his early years, because Hitler did not get along well with his father, he took solace in his Catholic faith. And he becomes an altar boy, and also he ends up admiring a hooked cross that he sees carved into a wall. When Hitler was in his teens, his father passes away. His father had always insisted that Hitler should go to school, and he wanted Hitler to become a civil servant just like he was. But Hitler hated school, but he does stay for a while, because he enjoys taking drawing lessons, and he also enjoys the subject of history. And this is something that he talks about in Mein Kampf. Even so, Hitler begins to lose interest in school, and he starts to set his sights on the Vienna Art Academy. However, he's a bit delayed when he learns that his mother, who is under 50 years old, is indeed very ill. She has surgery, and at around this time, Hitler has an opportunity to visit his grandparents. So eventually, he goes off, and he does go to Vienna, and as we all know, he applies to art school, but he's rejected for the history painting curriculum that he very much wanted. And he's told that he ought to consider architecture. And he does give this a bit of thought. However, he really did not enjoy school at all, and he would have to go back to school in order to get some prerequisites to become an architect. Now, shortly after his very upsetting initial rejection from the Vienna Art Academy, Hitler is called back home. His mother's health has really declined, and he's greatly emotionally affected by her illness. She's always been a very gentle, pious woman, but at the age of only 47 years old, she has a horrible death from cancer. Now, at around this time, at least according to this author, Hitler becomes very influenced by Nietzsche. And in combination with his reading and also the situation with his mother, he begins to question his Catholic faith and indeed all of Christianity. At around this time, he also discovers the Renzi opera. And this is an opera set in Italy about an Italian who tries to revive Rome. And he realizes that this opera is calling him to his destiny. Now, as we know, Hitler was a selfless lover, both of Germany and also of art. And he persuades his friend Gustl to move to Vienna and go to the music conservatory. Unlike Hitler, Gustl gets in right away. Not only does he get into the conservancy, but he becomes a violinist in an orchestra. Now, Hitler is so pained by this that he really cannot stay with Gustl anymore. And more his interests drift into politics, which is so prevalent in Vienna in those days. And he dreams of remaking society, and he wants to help the poor. At around this time when he's having all these dreams and visions, he's contacted by his sister Angela. She's recently had a baby, and that would be the famous Gigli. She tells Hitler that really, it's time for him to be responsible. Essentially, Hitler has been receiving an inheritance since his father's death. But Angela tells Hitler that he really needs to find some work because the extra money needs to go to his sister Paula. Hitler is very distressed by this conversation. He's uninterested in conventional work, despite, of course, how practical it would be. And he comes to the realization that he cannot stand either to be around his family or to be around his friend Gustl. So it becomes a somewhat lonely time for Hitler. However, he starts to get more involved in painting. Fortunately, he's able to support himself by selling these small postcard watercolor paintings. And fortunately, he is able to earn enough that he can send the modest inheritance that he's getting to his sister Paula, who really does need some assistance. In 1913, Hitler moves to Germany. And he's overjoyed with this. And he even applies for a third time to the art school in Munich. But he finds that their demands are even more stringent than those in Vienna. As we all know, Hitler gets into a bit of trouble with the Austrian government because he really should have registered for the draft. But he claims that he's a penniless artist who cannot take any time off. Hitler is fortunate in this respect that he's been living a rather meager lifestyle. So when he shows up for the physical for the Austrian military, he does look rather weak and possibly even diseased. And the doctor dismisses him. However, when the First World War actually breaks out, as we all know, he writes to King Ludwig II of Bavaria, and he volunteers. Now, he does this because he believes that Germany has a great destiny, and he must answer the call. So suddenly, he's not weary or weak or burdened by career. Instead, he's zealous, and he wants to really go into the danger zone during the war. And as we know, he receives many decorations, yet he's never promoted. Now, this is somewhat, or even largely, because at this point in Germany, you really have to be nobility to really get promoted, and Hitler is really just a commoner. But also, too, he enjoys the action because he's a message courier, and he's involved in very dangerous work. And he's really very brave and very selfless throughout the war. And he really loves the idea that he could lay down his life at any time. Again, this book tells the story of the fact that he gets a brief furlough during World War I in relation to some sort of a leg or hip injury. It also talks about the dog that he briefly adopted and trained, but apparently this dog at one point either wanders off or is stolen from him. The author also claims that at around this time, Hitler had some of his watercolor paintings stolen, and this causes him to become, according to the author, disillusioned with art. However, the official version of this story in Mein Kampf is that Hitler quit painting because of the damage done to his eyes by the mustard gas. Now, as we all know, in October of 1918, obviously at the very end of World War I, Hitler is temporarily blinded by the mustard gas. And he goes into the hospital, and he's there until the end of the war, just a month later. The author tells a somewhat different story of this experience in the hospital than you'll read in Mein Kampf. At any rate, after this, Hitler stays in the military and goes into anti-Bolshevik training in Bavaria. And this is when he discovers the German Workers' Party. More and more, he's pointed towards this prediction that he will have a leadership role in Germany. The author talks a little bit about the putsch in 1933 and his imprisonment, and how he uses the courtroom as a forum for his views. She also talks about how Hitler is able to buy a newspaper, and by the early 1920s is greatly influencing public opinion and finding a leadership role. The author promises further additions to this journal. Now, I know I've gone on fairly long here, but I wanted to make a special presentation given that we are approaching April 20th. So have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from a truck stop just north of Sacramento. Yesterday, as I was going past Coburg, Oregon, I saw a big banner there on the Marathon Luxury Motor Coach plant that they are hiring. And for those of you that are looking for a job, employment, whatever, they are hiring painters, bodymen, plumber, mechanic, cabinet door and drawer installer, electronics systems specialist, cabinet drafter, cabinet laminator, software programmer, electrician, cabinet installer, cabinet builder, RV service technician, upholsterer, flooring installer, and quality assurance assistant. And I got that from their website. So if you've got the technology to listen to this podcast, then you probably are savvy enough to make a few computer keyboard clicks and go to themarathoncoach.com and click on their employment for that plant. And hey, you know that we're talking those big bluebird sized luxury coach buses and trailers and stuff. So they must, I'm assuming they would be paying halfway decently. And it's in the homeland, nice area just north of Eugene, Oregon. So thought I'd throw that out there. You know, just there's jobs to be had. All you have to do is search around a little bit. Like I said, a couple of keyboard clicks, and that's what I came up with. Granted, I ended up driving past the plant to know about it, but hey, so I'm throwing it out to those of you that are considering moving out here. There you go. There's other jobs to be had, I'm sure. Other places hiring up here. It's not like it's a vast wasteland. There's all kinds of employment needed up here. You just gotta do a few computer searches and look around and then find one, make your move, and there you are. You'll be in the homeland, employed. So, okay, well, this is a little real quickie from the trucker. Out here, on the road, waiting to see most of you, hopefully, making your scouting trips and your migration to the homeland. All right, this is the trucker, signing off.
They say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old bandit run.
Well, spring is coming to the homeland. The weather's turning. It's getting kind of nice out, and that's put me in a bit of an Irish mood. These are the High Kings.
In the merry month of June, from me home I started, left the girls of June, nearly broken hearted, salute to father dear, kiss me darling mother, drank a pint of beer, me grief and tears to smother, then off to reap the corn, leave where I was born, cut to stealth back torn, to banish ghosts and goblins, a brand new pair of brogues, rattling o'er the bogs, frightening all the dogs, on the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whack the hare and turn her down the rocky road, all the way to Dublin, whack for lolly rock. In Mullingar that night I rested limbs so weary, started by daylight, me spirits bright, and airy took a drop of the pure, keep me heart from sinking, that's the paddy's cure, whenever he's on for drinking, to see the lassie smile, laughing all the while, at me curious style, would set your heart to bubbling, and asked if I was hard, wages I required, till I was nearly tired of the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, hut the hare and turn her down the rocky road, all the way to Dublin, whack full lolly rock. In Dublin next arrived, I thought it such a pity to be so soon deprived of view of that fine city. Well, then I took a stroll, all among the quality bundle it was stole, all in a neat locality. Something crossed me mind when I looked behind, no bundle could I find upon me sake. A woman inquiring for the road sent me Connacht Road, wasn't much in vogue on the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hut the hare and turn her down the rocky road, all the way to Dublin, whack for lolly rock. Was dead, a better far instead, on the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
safely landed, called myself a fool, I could no longer stand it, blood began to boil, temper I was losing, poor old Aaron's Isle, they began abusing, hurrah, me so I wish a lady I looked like, Galway boys were nigh, and so I was a hobbling with a loud hooray, joined in the affray, we quickly cleared the way, for the rocky road to Dublin, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Turner down the rocky road, all the way to Dublin, whack for lolly ra,
whack for lolly ra, whack for lolly ra.
Right. Now I must once again do what I've developed such a movement reputation for doing down through the years, and I have to speak of things that you really don't want to hear and discuss things that most of you really, really wish did not have to be discussed, but they do. Now let me start with a quick recap. What is this so-called alt-right that's appeared over the past few years? Well, first I have to tell you what the alt-right is not. It is not an actual movement as such. It's basically just a collection of several hundred people who spend a lot of time talking on the internet. It did have a brief existence outside the internet for about 18 months or so, but that's mostly gone now. Secondly, the alt-right is not us. The Northwest Front has nothing to do with the alt-right, and neither do any serious white nationalists or white separatists. How could we, since the alt-right accepts as leaders and public spokesmen people who are morally unfit for any participation at all in this historically vital and holy cause? One of the primary requisites for leadership in a political or social or religious movement is that the men and women involved in that leadership must practice what they preach. They must set an example. They must personify in their own lives and behavior the same values and principles which they advocate in public. That is simply not the case with the alt-right. I've joked with you that in my case, it's sometimes a case of do as I say and not as I do, but that's not true on the alt-right, since even basic racial eugenics and Aryan moral principles no longer seem to apply. The alt-right leadership, if you want to call it that, is riddled with Jews, with homosexuals, with race mixers, and with people who have, shall we say, quirky pasts and things about them that need to be looked at and evaluated long, hard, and carefully before accepting them even as fellow travelers, never mind leaders or public spokesmen. Not only that, but most of them no longer bother even to pretend to have any sense of personal or racial standards, morals, or cleanliness, because they've discovered that white Americans, especially the millennials, simply don't care. Now, I admit I don't have any exact statistics on this, but my observation over a period of decades is that most white people born after about 1975 are damaged goods in some way, because that's how they've been socially engineered. More and more white boys and girls appear to be growing up in single-parent families where either the feminist bitch wife and mother weaponized the law and drove the husband and father from the home through humiliation, divorce, and financial vampirism, or else the mother was a drunk and a druggie and a slut who ran off with some bum and left the father with the kids. White children are growing up in a world that has been niggerized in more ways than one. So it's not their fault that they genuinely don't see anything wrong with the filthy things that homosexuals do. They consider interracial sex to be a normal, everyday thing. They consider Jews to be white, and they consider such behaviors as informing to the FBI, testifying against their former associates in court, and having naked pictures of themselves on social media to be no biggie. Because from the playground on, they become accustomed to snitching as normal form of behavior to get over on others and get what they want. They've seen snitches glorified on TV and in the movies, so forth and so on. Now, in a larger sense, post-1975 white people have been raised to adulthood in one huge gray area, a world where there are no longer any moral absolutes of any kind. All ethics are situational. There are not just two sides to any story but many. And there are no absolutes, except, of course, that white people mustn't be racist. Now, this does not mean that all millennials are like that. I know they're not. Nor does it mean that all millennials lack any kind of self-awareness that they may have a problem. Many of them are so aware. I know because they tell me so. Most millennials who come to the movement do so because they feel instinctively that something is terribly wrong with the world into which they were born and raised, almost like they have some kind of genetic ancestral memory somewhere in their chromosomes of a time when things were different. They're looking for answers, and I'm always surprised by those among them who come to me privately and, with all due respect, ask me, Mr. Covington, what about this? What about that? Is this really true about the 1950s and 60s? Did that really happen? How were things done back then? In fact, one of the segments I'm considering adding to Radio Free Northwest is a feature called The Old Ways, which will be just like what it sounds. I'll answer your questions on just how our people really did do certain things back in the time before we were contaminated with Judaism and before we became so weak and timid and frightened. I'm doing it again, aren't I? Rambling on and on off topic. Okay, I'll get on with it. I'm now going to play for you a track from YouTube that was pointed out to me by Bill from Spokane. This is from a guy in England using the name Brutus of Troy. No idea who he is or what his ideological bent is. Now, some of what this Englishman says is spot on, and some of it's many miles off base. Not the least weird aspect of this is that most of the so-called alt-right leaders he mentions are compromised in some way with buggery or Jewishness, and he either isn't aware of the fact or he doesn't care. Now, he does seem to have a problem with Greg Johnson's wild-eyed bungholery, but on the other hand, the Millennial Woes incident seems to have escaped his notice. This, by the way, is common. Unless you make an effort to keep up with it all the scandals among the so-called alt-right leadership are so widespread that you need a flowchart to keep track of who's committing what perversion, who's a Jew, and who's turned out to be an undercover reporter, so forth and so on. Anyway, this is Brutus of Troy.
Right, guys, how's it going? So let's talk about blood sports, internet blood sports, Baked Alaska, and the latest round of gossip. I mean, first of all, let me apologize for all the gossip on this channel at the moment. There is a whole host of other things which I would like to talk about, but this is just the way that the alt-right is. I want people to not despair about all the infighting and the general explosive nature of the alt-right. The alt-right is invincible. It will continue to march on. People in the alt-right have been at each other's throats ever since its inception, and it has gone through multiple bust-ups and break-ups and disagreements and character clashes, and it will continue to do so. It is a revolutionary movement, and we can't expect things to be peaceful, and we can't really expect people to get along. I have just completely given up on it, to be perfectly honest with you, and I suggest that you do so too. And I suggest that what people need to understand is people need to ditch the notion that we're some kind of brotherhood. I mean, when I first got involved with white nationalism, I thought I was entering into some kind of brotherhood, you know, where everybody stands together and looks after each other and stands strong against the enemy. And this is just simply not true. And I think on reflection, it was unreasonable for me to expect it to be that way. And the mistake is, basically the mistake is thinking that any of these e-celebrities are your friends, right? They're not your friends. They're not my friends, right? Mike Enoch, Richard Spencer, Andrew Anglin, Christopher Cantwell, Millennial Woes. None of these people are your friends. Even if you have some slight personal contact with them, they're not really your friends. What they are is they are people in the political arena, right? Let me put it this way. If you have some disaster, if you crash your car, you lose your job, so whatever happens, you've got some personal grief going on in your life, are you going to phone up Andrew Anglin, Christopher Cantwell, Millennial Woes? Are you going to phone them up and say, oh, can you help me because of X, Y, and Z? You're not going to do it because they're not really your friends, right? What they are is they are e-celebrities and they're politicians. No different from any other political movement or political party for that matter. They are politicians in the public sphere who are jostling for fame and recognition and influence and power. That's what it is. It's a power game. This whole idea of the alt-right is a brotherhood of men fighting against the Jews, it's just not real, okay? It's just not real. If you're a member of the audience, you have to understand these people are not your friends. And if you are a public figure that's putting yourself out there, you also have to understand that the other public figures that you are interacting with, they're not your friends either. It's a power game. And that's just the way it is. And I don't mean that, that doesn't mean that people have to be at each other's throats all the time. There can be alliances and so on and so forth. But it's, you know, it's a political game. This idea of white nationalist brotherhood, unfortunately, is very unrealistic. And once you understand that, and once you accept that, it does make life a lot easier, right? I made the mistake of thinking there were a few, there was a white nationalist blogger and a white nationalist guy that does podcasts. I made the mistake of thinking that these people were my friends, right? They're not my friends. They're not my friends. And once you understand that and you get over that, then it makes life a lot easier because you realize what's actually going on. It's kind of like you take the red pill in regard to your alt-right relationships. And it also means it gives you more freedom to just say whatever you want to say. You want to criticize people, you want to speak the truth, right? Don't worry about offending people because these people don't really have your back anyway, right? So just speak the truth. That's my conclusion. And just, yeah, realize the struggle for what it is and just be a little bit more thick-skinned. I think all of these white nationalist personalities need to be a little bit more thick-skinned. They have to realize that they are media personalities and they are open to criticism. And they can't pull this, oh, you're punching right, don't criticize me. We all have to stand together in solidarity because it's bullshit. Everyone's at everybody else's neck all the time. So don't hide behind this, oh, you can't criticize me. You're a media personality. You're on YouTube. You're putting yourself out there. You are open to criticism, right? It's open season. So just deal with it. So yeah, I just want to put that out there, first of all. And just, yeah, just don't worry about the alt-right. Don't worry about all the infighting. This is just natural. It's a way for the movement to grow, to be perfectly honest with you. And it helps the movement grow. When Richard Spencer did his Hailgate, you know, we managed to get rid of a lot of fake people who were saying that they were alt-right. When we had the Thoughtgate scandal, we managed to properly establish that women in the alt-right should not be complaining about getting trolled online and they shouldn't be trying to get guys to defend them on the internet. And now we've got this whole Doxgate scandal with Paul Neelan, Christopher Cantwell, Ricky Vaughan, and this whole thing that's going on. It's again, it's another way for the alt-right to purge itself and to overcome certain obstacles and to move on. And what I believe will emerge from this scandal is these people, this Andrew Anglin and this Mike Enoch, they're going to realize pretty quickly that they are not able to censor people that they don't want to talk to. And they are going to have to answer for what they've done. And they've tried to, they started an entire optics debate, criticized over and over and over again people who wanted to demonstrate on the streets. They caused a division within the alt-right. And then when Paul Neelan doxed Ricky, they used that as an excuse to say, okay, now we can totally censor Christopher Cantwell and Paul Neelan. Now we can remove them from the movement. And they're not going to get away with it. They're not going to get away with it. Why? Because of internet blood sports. Which is something which I've been meaning to talk about for a long time, but I really do believe that internet blood sports will save the white race. I know I say that a lot, but it's definitely a key component because what blood sports forces people to do is to talk to each other, right? It's basically a gladiator ring, right? You are going to get summoned into the ring and you will be forced to defend your opinions. Now, I personally don't really agree with this whole idea of people screaming at each other, you know, on the internet. And, you know, a gang of three or four people shouting at a gang of three or four people. It's not really my cup of tea. Some people like that kind of thing. I'm not really interested in it. And I personally wouldn't want ever to get involved in that kind of thing because you can't have a serious discussion. You know, you can't get down to the nitty gritty when you've got just people screaming at each other. But the idea of having debates and the idea of being called out and, you know, say, look, mate, you said this X, Y, and Z, you have to defend your opinions. This is very, very good and very, very healthy. And it's about time that the alt-right embraced it. I mean, it's been a slow and steady progress. I remember the first debate, or one of the first debates was last year. Do you remember when Beardson Beardley challenged the Goyim goddess? I know that was a bit of a joke debate, but it was a good debate. And I remember actually, interestingly, at that time, Beardson Beardley challenged Weave to a debate, you know, over the white Sharia meme. And Weave refused to debate him, which I thought was utterly cowardly. And it's very representative of the kind of attitude that these people have. They think that they can censor. Andrew Anglin, Weave, Mike Enoch. They think that they don't have to answer people's questions. They can get away with it. You know, they can kick people off their forums and they can kick people out of the movement. And they're not going to get away with it. Not in 2018. Not when we have this culture of debate on the internet. So, you know, in the past, white nationalist movements would develop, they'd grow, people would start infighting, and then everybody would just fall out and split up. This all happened because people didn't debate, they didn't talk to each other. Now the audience, the people that sit in the comment sections, the people that follow the alt-right, they are going to demand that these people talk, and they will talk. There will be a showdown. Andrew Anglin will be forced to talk to Christopher Cantwell and Paul Neelan, and there will be a showdown, and we will progress, and we will move forwards. And this is the beauty of blood sports. And I believe that we need to keep pushing this culture of debate more and more and more, and just keep sucking people into this debate. There are a lot of personalities out there who still have not come to the table, so to speak. I've yet to see E. Michael Jones, like, do the rounds on this whole internet debate thing. And I would be very interested to see him do it because he's such a very intelligent scholar. I've yet to see Eric Dubay do the rounds on this internet bloodsport things. That would be very interesting. I'd like to see Varg Vikernes step up and try to defend some of his interesting opinions. I would like to see some of these old school white nationalists like Harold Covington or who's that guy? Billy Roper. I'd like to see these guys step up and try to defend some of the opinions that they have. And in this way, by cultivating this culture of debate, stupid opinions can get eliminated quite easily. If you're like Varg Vikernes and you think that you can survive white genocide by hiding in the forest, well, you're not going to be able to hold that opinion for very long if you're in part of a culture which has these kinds of rigorous debates, this kind of punching right, this kind of criticism. Another key character is Greg Johnson, who is a homosexual and he likes to suck men's cocks. How is it that we have a homosexual sitting right at the heart of white nationalism? I'll tell you why he's able to sit there. He's able to sit there because people don't challenge him about it. If we have more of a culture of debate and more of a culture of challenge, then he wouldn't be able to get away with doing what he's doing. So this is the beauty of blood sports. As I say, I've been meaning to talk about this for a long time. I've been thinking this for a long time. But the more we allow this blood sport to grow and the more this thing develops, the more it becomes an important aspect of internet culture, we should hopefully force everybody to answer and everybody into the debate. Paul Joseph Watson, Ann Coulter, Peter Hitchens, and also the politicians themselves. There are a lot of MPs out there in England, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in, I don't know, the House of Representatives in America or governors or people in the lower echelons of government who would, I'm sure they would love to have a little bit of publicity. I mean, can you imagine if we start dragging government officials into internet blood sports and we start making them answer our questions, the questions of the people? So it's a way to kind of bypass the political system. We create a culture where people are forced to debate and forced to defend their opinions. And again, I'm not really in favor of people screaming at each other. I don't think it's very productive, but definitely reasonable debate. And with a good moderator as well. So people can't get away with all the nonsense that they pull. And yeah, that's it, guys. And what was the latest bit of internet gossip which I wanted to talk about? Well, apparently Baked Alaska has Baked Alaska emerged as a freedom of speech kind of personality, and he joined the alt-right, and good for him. You know, he went to Charlottesville, he got sprayed in the face with acid. He fought through the wars, but now he's turned against his audience, and he's trying to censor his audience, and I don't know what's going on with this guy. He's moved back to Los Angeles, he's got himself a manager, he's got some really skanky, dumb, annoying blonde woman sitting next to him. Like, I don't even know what's going on. I really don't follow these live streams. I really don't even follow the gossip that much, to be honest with you. The only reason I've got involved in the gossip recently is because the alt-right has turned against Paul Neelan, which is just the dumbest thing ever. So I feel like I have to get involved. Yeah, I don't know. He's turned against his audience and he's saying that he wants to get rid of toxic people in the chat room. You know, and it's again, it's another case of censorship. Like, you people just can't get away with this anymore, you know? And apparently he's flagging people on YouTube and getting their videos taken down and their channels taken down if they fight with him. So this is a serious level of bullshit here. But there you go, guys. That's the latest piece of gossip. I don't even really know what the conclusion of that is. It's just one more character came into the alt-right, got chewed up, got spat out. But don't worry, guys, the movement will keep marching forwards because we don't have a choice. We don't have anywhere to run to. We've got our backs against a wall and we have no choice but to fight. You know, it's like that old thing, like you don't back a tiger against the wall, but don't back a wild animal against the wall because he will just be forced to fight tooth and nail. And that is what has happened to the alt-right, to the white race even. We don't have a choice. So people are still going to be going on the internet and they're going to be fighting and they're going to be speaking up about this stuff. We're not like the baby boomer white nationalist generation who could just kind of ignore things and sweep it under the carpet and think, oh God, everything's going wrong, but I'll just be safe, you know, in my house in the suburbs somewhere. We don't have that option. And so we have to fight. So don't worry about the alt-right dying or anything like that. It's not going to die because, you know, white people are still being killed everywhere. So there will always be an unending stream of angry white people going on the internet to complain about this. So there you go, guys. That's my thoughts about that. God bless. Thanks for listening.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. I've been very busy lately and my schedule keeps filling up, or else I'd be on here more. I apologize for my absence, and I would like to note that I'm going unscripted today and working off of a set of notes, so I'm even more sorry if this presentation isn't up to my usual standards. Comrade Bill, who some of you have heard here on Radio Free Northwest in the past, sent Harold and I a video clip of a request for a more lively debate environment in the movement in general. The topic wasn't so much specified, but it was asked for the NF to justify or defend more of its claims. The topic could be anything, but Bill suggested that it would be armed revolution versus system politics. Well, okay. Here's the thing. The party isn't exactly big on debates, and there are reasons for that. Chief among them would be human nature. Now, human nature is something I brought up repeatedly on RFN, particularly during my Real Politics lectures and my Theorycraft shortcasts. To repeat, facts do not change minds. I understand why someone would think they do, but not in reality, and there are other things going on when someone chooses to adopt a new ideology or change their previous beliefs. But more on that later. And since I've mentioned my Theorycraft shortcasts, remember that being proven wrong is one of the worst things that can happen to someone, even if that person thinks they want to know the truth. In reality, people do not appreciate it, and being proven wrong, especially in a public way, tends to harden someone's heart to truth, rather than cause them to change what they're doing to be in accordance with truth. And yeah, that's a little bit goofy, but again, experience shows this to be the case. I'll also note, and I'll cover more on the issues of new and naive white nationalists later, but I must also note that the premise was debate rather than debate spurring action, and I detect a little bit of insincerity. Might I be wrong here? Well, of course. But given how things are with the white character issue and how they're more or less not changing, I don't think I am wrong. I think it's very important to point out that this is merely more entertainment for the sake of seeing who's really right and this obsession with what is and isn't factually accurate. Action based on those realities be damned. Okay, I'm cynical, but if you had my experience with these subjects, you'd be cynical too. Even so, I'll set aside my cynicism long enough to actually explore what such a debate would be like. Firstly, when has the NF, as is implied by this video I was sent, not proven its claims? We actually bend over backwards to provide all the proof necessary, and we actively pass it around to anyone and everyone interested when it's requested. Now, as odd as it is to say this, in light of what the alt-right was and has become, remember, prior to the advent of the alt-right, the issue of what it would take to actually halt white genocide on the North American continent had largely been settled. The movement had been reduced to a relative handful of people trying to get involved with the NF and everyone else going, Harold Covington is the son of Satan. No, really, I'm not making that up. The NF had largely assumed primacy, and everyone took it as a flat fact that armed revolution was necessary. Further, we actually go out of our way, as I said, to support the claims we make with evidence. A good example of that would be recordings of Mike the Kike Enot talking about his own Jewishness very openly into hot microphones in front of all sorts of people, repeatedly. But nobody really cares, and that just goes back to the issue of facts don't change minds. Briefly, I want to discuss a Twitter incident from this last week where, once again, that subject came up and everybody piled on Harold and I was forced to interact with some people for a little bit. The stance I have taken lately is that nobody really cares, so I'm not going to bother getting into this argument. I will briefly mention that YouTube has all sorts of compilations of these clips with all sorts of commentary from all sorts of sources added on top of them, and really any of them is good. If someone actually wants to know whether or not Mike the Kike Enoch has admitted to being Jewish, they can just go YouTube search that and get the answer immediately. Except that somebody didn't want to do that. Instead, one person kept repeatedly saying, I just don't care about those clips and they're not good proof and they don't do the job and so on and so forth. And then later, in a different tweet thread, this very same person said, hey, none of you linked me that material, so I don't think it exists. Note that they claim to have heard them and not care, and they were forced into a corner verbally, and all of a sudden wanted to admit that, oh, I didn't even bother looking. So when we talk about a debate changing someone's mind, I really, really, really don't care. Now, I don't know how representative those people are that do these things, but it's been a regular occurrence in social media for someone to just outright disregard hard facts about that situation. Now, I bring up that story as an example for a very specific reason. I want to contrast it with my own experience. When I was first exposed to the Northwest Imperative and the Butler Plan, I didn't live anywhere near Seattle. In fact, I was almost on the other side of the country entirely. Even so, I recognized that it was a very serious proposal because nobody else even had any sort of a plan as to how to actually halt white genocide, and that goes for the system politics people even now, by the way. They don't actually have a clue what they're talking about, but we'll get there in a second. Anyway, I knew it was on me to research whether or not this process I thought was going to fail and therefore be the wrong thing to do would actually fail, and I went to the party's recommended reading list, read the Northwest Independence novels, researched all of the historical instances of someone doing this, and it turns out that you would never ever think they would succeed, but they do with shocking frequency, because they attempt it with a serious mindset and have an actual measurable goal they acquire by means that have been historically proven to acquire said goals. The issue is, when someone actually cares whether or not they're wrong, they don't wait for a spoon-fed debate format to change their minds. They go figure it out on their own. And I also need to make the point that in a debate, the system politics people would get shredded at about 30 seconds flat, which is the other reason I just don't want to bother with the debate, because nothing that interesting would come out of it. The system politics people to date have proposed a number of wildly absurd and entirely unfeasible situations that they would try to bring about to cause the government to expel these 150 million plus undesirables that we just have to get rid of one way or another if we're going to take it all back. It ain't going to happen. And to be perfectly honest, there's this issue called burden shifting. People asking the NF to explain or justify its claims are burden shifting because what they want to have happen is even more absurd than an armed revolution against the federal government. But more on that in a second. Anytime the NF ends up debating someone in any medium, we always bring up the issue of how are you going to actually clean everything up in terms of the racial environment. And no one has even thought through that outside the NF, because in reality, most of these Johnny-come-lately wannabe pseudo-nationalist kiddies don't understand that the underlying issue isn't the culture or laws or Jews or anything else. Now, all of that matters, certainly, but the underlying issue is the proximity of different racial types. Go read March of the Titans, because that is a good example of how these things play out over long periods in history. So we do actually have this debate all the time, just in small groups. And the fact of the matter is, the burden shifting does occur because the people doing the burden shifting don't understand what the real underlying problem is. The NF has explained how we're going to handle the situation, and the system politics people don't even know what the actual situation is. But why would someone burden shift like that? Well, it has to do with new and naive people in movements, and that's something else I need to talk about. I recently had cause to discuss this person to person with a couple people meeting the party for the first time, and I did a little bit of this with Comrade Bill over email, but I absolutely have to touch on that so we understand what really is going on here. People new to any sort of movement, whether it be religious, political, whatever, they all have certain characteristics, and those characteristics are indicative of someone whose opinion I really just don't have time to mess with. Ed, yeah, that sounds like I'm being a total asshole, and I might be, but again, I have experience in this matter. I would prefer people start to trust my judgment about it. The first sign that someone is so new that, well, we may not exactly care what they have to say is that, one, they're absolutely obsessed with waking people up, and they're overly concerned with proving themselves by way of debate. Yeah, young me was interested in that sort of stuff, but again, nobody's perfect. I got over it. You need to get over it, too. All of these issues were settled prior to the alt-right's advent, and nothing the alt-right has done has changed any of it. I'm much more interested in merely referring people back to the material that I dealt with and letting them do what they need to do with it. And the other thing that is a dead giveaway that someone is brand spanking new to some movement is that they're absolutely concerned with voting their way out of whatever they don't like. Now, okay, I can understand that in a political movement, but how many times are we going to have examples post-Trump that we're not going to get what we need from the Zog political system? I'll leave that one be since I'm running long and starting to ramble, but I think you understand what I'm saying. Lastly, I'll close with this. As I said, we have this debate all the time, and we actually have quite a bit of experience winning the argument, but it never actually gets us anywhere, which is yet another reason I just don't care about formal debates. I wish I had something else to tell you, but the fact of the matter is, our experience shows us that it's just not a productive activity. Anyway, I've gone on long enough, and this really has turned rambly, so I'm going to shut up now. A hail victory, comrades, and have a good week.
Okay, this is one of those instances when I'm going to have to choose my words very carefully to make absolutely sure that everybody understands what I'm saying here. Now, I can't make you guys act on it, but I can at least make sure you understand it so you won't have any excuse for not acting on it. Andy is entirely correct in his assertion that debates would not just be non-productive but counterproductive, because the alt-righters who clearly lost would not admit that they lost and change their behavior accordingly. They would simply get all pissed off because their egos got all but hurt and humiliated, and they double down on their resistance to the Northwest Imperative and their attacks on the NF. The Soros media have said it. We now live in the post-factual age, and all that matters is the narrative. Now, they claim that this is something that's just happened since Donald Trump became president, but I can tell you that the white nationalist movement has been in the post-factual age for some time. Try 50 years, at least. Now, one of the things that I learned many years ago is that our people, white nationalist people, believe whatever they want to believe. And once their minds are made up, facts quite literally do not matter. Now, rather than ramble on about that, Grandpa Simpson is going to give you guys a very specific example from the days of yore. Please bear with me during this long digression. I assure you there is a point to it. Now, some of you will remember the Portland lawsuit case of the early 1990s when, through the vehicle of an abusive civil lawsuit from Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center, Tom Metzger of the White Aryan Resistance Group was held legally liable for the behavior of a young man whom he had never met in his life and whom he did not even know existed. Yes, that is possible in our glorious legal system. Now, for those of you who don't know who Tom Metzger was, Google him. He's pretty much forgotten now. Last I heard of him, he was living in seclusion on some farm in Indiana he inherited from an aunt or something, although it seems to me I heard somewhere that he died, but if so, nobody's bothered to update his Wikipedia entry. Anyway, Metzger was one of the more extreme examples of one of our people being victimized by Morris Dees. Because of Dees, Metzger lost his home, his private business, and everything he owned in a crushing civil judgment from a jury of liberals and niggers in Portland, Oregon, amounting to millions of dollars. In order to collect this judgment, Dees and his paid agents from the legal system invaded Metzger's home in San Diego and not only took the house itself and took all his stuff, literally stripping the place down to the bare walls, which is apparently legal in California, but they hauled all of his racial books and newspapers and literature out onto the front lawn and burned it in a bonfire to the wild cheers and conga dancing of a crowd of so-called neighbors. Now, these scum, in fact, were not Tom Metzger's neighbors. They were the usual left-wing rent-a-mob whom Dees imported for the occasion. Now, while all this was going on, Tom's real neighbors were busy doing what white people always do when confronted with racial assault and the tyranny of the oppressor's law. They were hiding away and cowering in their homes with the shades drawn, desperately looking away and pretending they didn't see. This was not October 22nd. Because Morris Dees confiscated everything that Metzger owned, his terminally ill wife Kathy died of cancer in a charity ward in a local hospital. Now, I'm mentioning all this so you listeners will understand the magnitude and the sheer disgrace of Tom Metzger's eventual contemptible capitulation to the Southern Poverty Law Center. In order to be able to continue to collect donation money from white people who considered him to be a leader, rather than devote the rest of his life to resisting the evil that had been done to him, as I did when I was confronted with similar circumstances, Tom Metzger eventually signed a legal consent decree with the man who murdered his wife. A court-appointed receiver was allowed to collect the mail from Metzger's then well-known Box 65 in Fallbrook, California. Now, this is called a till-tap in legal parlance. This court-appointed receiver then went through the mail, which unsuspecting white people sent to WAR. You see, Metzger never told the people who corresponded with him that he was no longer collecting the mail at the post office box, and their letters and donations were ending up in the hands of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The court-appointed official receiver noted down the names and addresses of the people who were sending Metzger money, photocopied their letters and checks, and handed them over to the SPLC. From there, this data presumably went to the FBI, the Mossad, etc. For many years, if you wrote a letter to Tom Metzger, you were sending your name and the contents of that letter directly to the secret police. God alone knows how many years of prison time has been handed down because of the intelligence that the dictatorship was able to accumulate in this manner. The official receiver took the checks, money orders, and cash and deposited them in a special bank account, the rubber-stamped endorsement of which appeared on the back of checks made out to white Aryan resistance for many years, carefully disguising the nature and true owners of the account. The receiver then gave 50% of the income from the post office box to the Southern Poverty Law Center in payment of the civil judgment and cut a check to Metzger for the other half, which is what he lived on. During his last years, Tom Metzger, who pretended in public to be a white resistance leader, was in fact an employee of the Southern Poverty Law Center. Metzger spent the rest of his days denying this fact, but what you all need to understand is that there is no doubt, none at all, that this was happening. This obscene and despicable arrangement was first exposed in the Montgomery Advertiser newspaper in early 1994 in a special supplement on the SPLC. To this day, it is a matter of public record in court proceedings regarding the Portland lawsuit, and eventually Metzger himself stopped denying it once he realized that it didn't matter, and there is an endless supply of fresh suckers out there in white folks' land. At the time, a number of white nationalist figures, including myself, Dr. Ed Fields, the late Rick Cooper, and many others, were appalled and horrified at what Metzger was doing. We did everything we could to alert Metzger's supporters as to what was being done to them, with the predictable result that we were all immediately subject to a shitstorm of abuse, insult, smears, slander, threatening, and what today would be called doxing or trolling, even though this occurred in about the last couple of years before the internet came into being. Mostly this came from Metzger's young skinhead followers, but Metzger himself never hesitated to get his hands shitty. He would get on his recorded message while he was clearly drunk and shout out my home address while urging his shaven-headed children of the night to kill, kill my pretties, that kind of thing. This was when I was living in Seattle for the first time around, and Metzger actually sent in a spy to find out where I was living and where I was working, and he then sent a television news crew to my alleged place of employment, where they found only an Eastern European immigrant who yelled and shouted at them in Serbo Croatian. And just so you guys know how long this kind of behavior has been going on, it definitely predates the internet. Okay, what is the point of all of this long, rambling crap, I hear you ask? I'll tell you, because it's the perfect illustration of the point Andy just made. At the height of all this hanna-hanna, I obtained from the postmaster in Fallbrook, California, a letter on official stationery confirming that this filthy arrangement was real and that Tom Metzger's mail was being intercepted and collected and disposed of by an officer of the court. The postmaster had to respond because these things are matters of public record. This being the pre-internet days, like I said, I took it to a Kinko's and I ran off hundreds of photocopies of this letter, and I mailed them to what had to be, at the time, pretty much every white nationalist or strong conservative or conspiracy theorist address in the country. Possibly some of you guys listening to this received those letters. I might as well have saved myself the postage. No one believed me. I produced about as solid a proof as it's possible to produce that Tom Metzger was lying and I was telling the truth, and it was all simply ignored. As I recall, I never received any indication that any of my months of distributing that letter or the Montgomery Advertiser article or the court orders that Rick Cooper found ever had the slightest effect as far as preventing people from handing over their names and money to the Southern Poverty Law Center by writing to Post Office Box 65, Fallbrook, California. White people have a seemingly endless capacity for self-delusion and for what's called solipsism, the creation of a separate reality that exists only in their heads and which they refuse to let go of under any circumstances. White people have an endless capacity to latch on to ideas and policies and tactics such as news commentary or the internet, which offer them comfort and an easing of their consciences without the danger and focused dedication and endless work of for real revolution. And they refuse to abandon these policies and practices under any circumstances, including total failure. You show a white man an easy way out, and he'll jump at it.
All right, children, let's clean up this room.
Aw, man, do we have to?
Now, I know a little secret that will make the job go twice as fast. If there's a task that must be done, don't turn your tail and run. Don't pout, don't sob, just do a half-assed job. Cut every corner, it is really not so bad. Everybody does it, even Mom and Dad. If nobody sees it, then nobody gets mad.
It's the American way.
The policeman on the beat needs some time to rest his feet.
Fighting crime is not my cup of tea.
And the clerk who runs the store can charge a little more for meat.
For meat.
And milk.
And milk.
From 1984. Every corner you'll have more time for play.
It's the American way.
A debate on the internet between a couple of dudes whom only a few hundred people know who they are or care about who they are is an easy way to get out of doing any heavy lifting. It is a way for us to pretend that we are accomplishing something when all we are doing is continuing to generate words. The internet has the potential to be a world-conquering weapon in our hand, but it can also turn into a sandbox wherein we continue to play. Let me be very clear on something here. We already know what we're going to do about all of this. We're going to do the Northwest Imperative. We are going to establish the Northwest American Republic as a homeland for all white people the world over. That's what we're going to do. That's pretty much decided simply through the absence of any other idea of any kind at all that has any remote chance of actually achieving anything. You might say it's been decided for us. I mean, there quite literally isn't anything else other than the Northwest Imperative. There is no need to debate this. There is no need to engage in endless navel-gazing or batting ideas back and forth like you were liberal professors sitting in the faculty lounge at Harvard or anything like that. People, listen very carefully. The debate is over. You may not know it, but it is. We already know what we're going to do about all this. We have to stop wasting time on the internet. We need to start using the internet to advance the cause and the development of the Northwest American Republic, because it's been decided that's what we're going to do. In fact, I think from now on, that's one of our slogans we need to start using. I mean, I myself have been posting this on Twitter for some time now. The Northwest Front. It's what we're going to do about all this. But our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Underban. Freedom.